In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Ed Brubaker is back, and much like his friends Brian Bendis and Greg Rucka, when I talk to Ed, it's always a multi-hour conversation. So, giving it its own name, we debut The Brubaker Testimony. Criminal is about to start a new arc called The Sinners, and Ed is here to talk about that. We also look at a wrap-up of the first Incognito arc and discuss its real and fictionalized pulp hero roots. You'll also hear plenty about Captain America and the Marvels Project. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. You'll find a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, anything. If it's in trades, you're likely to find it at InStockTrades.com with retail prices slashed down to up to 40% off for major publishers. For example, if you haven't started reading Criminal from Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips and Val Staples, a great way to start is by ordering the trades from InStockTrades.com. Various arcs of Criminal that have been collected, the standard retail price usually is $14.99. At InStockTrades, just $7.94. And then in the special Dead and the Dying trade, which lists at $11.99, you can get it from InStockTrades.com for just $7.55. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. For all the details, check out their websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Word Balloon is beginning a book club, and InStockTrades.com is our partner. We will be giving you details and the first title in our book club in the weeks ahead, so keep listening to WordBalloon.com for more information. But for now, we start our talk with Ed Brubaker, The Brubaker Testimony, Part 1, right here on Word Balloon. Let's start with Criminal, because as you told me, the publicity campaign has begun. The new arc is coming. It started in the last issue of Incognito, and I want to eventually talk about that as well.
Oh, cool.
But,
up today.
Oh, I sure did, man. Oh, it was
awesome.
A great wrap-up. But first, Criminal. Here we are. Tracy Lawless is back?
Yeah, it's the return of Tracy Lawless. I had originally intended to come back to Leo first and do the sequel to Coward, which is Coward's Way Out, which was the prison break story. I guess spoilers. But when the book is called Coward's Way Out, I guess it's kind of self-evident that that's what it's about when it's about a guy in prison.
Fair enough.
he could make a deal, I suppose, to get out. I had originally planned to do that as my next thing, but then I just kept, as I was working on Bad Night, I just kept thinking how much fun it was to write Tracy, because Bad Night was so hard to write, and just, you know, I felt like I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown while I was working on it, even though I think it's the best thing I've ever written, probably, but I was really, like, craving to just write somebody, like, really cold and violent and quiet. It just, I don't know, it just suddenly, and I'd been talking to a few different people who were telling me, you know, that Tracy was one of their favorite characters that I'd ever created, and they really wanted to see more of Tracy, and I was like, well, you know, he's kind of been itching to get out, so I started thinking about what he was up to next, even though I'd kind of had a few ideas about what he would be up to, but then I really started thinking about it and figuring out, okay, well, what's next for this guy, which is a lot of fun, actually. And, you know, I mean, I do that all the time with my, you know, Marvel and the stuff I did for DC. You're always figuring out, okay, well, what's next for Catwoman? What's next for Captain America? You know, but to do it with characters that you created yourself that, you know, I mean, shit, if Criminal had not been successful, you know, Lawless could have been the only time this guy appeared.
No, and I know that even when you were writing Lawless, you did hint to you would be getting back to Tracy's story. And
Yeah, the hope was always that, like, you know, at least a couple of these characters would end up being characters that we would return to time and time again. You know, just, I like series fiction a lot. I read a lot of series crime fiction, and, you know, I read a lot of non-series crime fiction and, you know, stuff too, but I always, you know, keep getting drawn back to these characters that, you know, you fell in love with in a couple of books, or you just really like the, you know, their style.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of those people who was really excited to find out Dennis Lehane was going back to, you know, writing another one of his PI books. I was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, awesome. Like, I've been wondering what they've been up to for the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I just like that. There's something, you know, even You know, I mean, shit, I read those John Sanford books, the Prey books.
Yes.
And, you know, the first 10 or 12 of those, I love. Like, I just thought they were really amazing, great crime books. And, you know, the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them, like, I read out of habit. Like, I'm not sure how much I actually enjoy them. I'm not sure how much he actually enjoys writing them. You know, but it's almost like a habit for both of us, I think, at this point. And, you know, I do generally, like, am unable to put them down while I'm reading them, so I shouldn't criticize him. I just, you know, after 25 books of the same series, you know.
No, I know.
How many serial murderers can this guy catch?
Well, exactly. And, I mean, I kind of feel that way sometimes with Robert Parker and Spencer. And I still love the books,
yeah,
and look forward to it every year. But you're right. It is kind of like a familiar friend that, like, comes to visit you once a year. And
yeah, and every now and then, one of the new ones really knocks you out, and you're like, oh,
yep,
this is as good as any of the, you know. That's how it was with the Parker novels, with Richard Stark's stuff. Like,
absolutely.
You know, like, the last few that he did, actually, I like as much as any of the early ones, in a weird way. Like, I just, you know, I like the one where he actually gets sent to prison, like, because that's something that had never happened to Parker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, he got caught. He got sent to prison. Like, that sucked, and he has to escape from prison. You know?
Yeah,
but,
and
yeah,
that...
when I really like a character, I'll just, you know, I'll just follow all their books, and, you know, it's the same as you know, I mean, serialized fiction. You know, it's,
sure,
it's different with crime fiction than it is with, you know, even like fantasy or sci-fi or something like that. Because with crime fiction, each book is like a completely new story. You're just following the same character through, you know, often a different kind of crime. You know, even with, like, Private Eye stuff, you know, it's always about the crime, not the character. So that's kind of cool.
Well, and I guess continuity fans are going to wonder where we are in the series fiction of Tracy. I mean, does it pick up right where we left off in Lawless?
No, it's about 9-10 months later. It's not quite Christmas again yet, but yeah, he's been working for Mr. Hyde. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, he made the deal at the end of Lawless, and I should say, you know, just for any people who've picked up Incognito and haven't yet picked up Criminal, who are going to try it out, that you know, it's each Criminal storyline is one of those, you know, you can pick it up at the beginning. You know, you don't need to have read everything that came before. Each of the books stands on their own. You know, while if you read them all, there's little Easter eggs for you. But
yes,
it's really, I mean, you know, it's, I try as hard as possible to make each of them, you know, something that anybody could just grab any of the books in any order and read them. Yeah, it's about a year later, and at the end of Lawless, you know, Tracy ended up in a shitty position, basically, you know, never wanting to be like his dad. He ends up doing the exact same job that his dad had, working for, you know, the city's biggest crime boss. And at the beginning of The Sinners, you know, we pick up, it's been about 10 months, almost a year, that he's been working for Mr. Hyde and his organization. And it turns out he's, like, the biggest pain in the ass as a hitman that you could ever possibly have. He's, like, he's constantly saying no. He's, like, researching his victims. Like, he won't just go follow orders, you know, which, you know, any Mr. Hyde had his military file, so he should have expected as much, because he was always, like, getting written up for insubordination and,
yep,
you know, going off on his own way. Yeah, he's a bit of a pain in the ass, and so that's kind of the beginning of the story, is Tracy trying to figure out if he's pushed his luck far enough that Mr. Hyde's going to send someone out to kill him.
Are we looking at a 6-issue arc or a 4-issue arc? What?
It's 5.
Okay.
Right now it says it's 5, but Incognito was going to be 5, and then it ended up being 6 with the 6th issue, you know, like
pretty dense,
12 pages long.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll end up being 5.
Okay.
The plan right now is 5, but it's with each of the criminal stories, I try to sort of, you know, give myself some kind of goal to push myself further than the previous ones. And, you know, with the Dead and the Dying, it was, you know, trying to do something different with the format, with the 3 interlinking stories and, you know, each told from a different point of view. And with Bad Night, obviously, it was, like, really experimental in the way it was told, and with the, you know, unreliable narrator and things like that. And with this one, I'm trying to sort of expand the scope of the story, actually. So it's got a much wider cast, and it kind of covers a lot more of the city. So you get to see, if you have been, you know, following the series all along and you've seen little bits and pieces of the city throughout the three modern storylines that we've done, mm-hmm. and you'll get to see a lot of those pieces and how they relate to each other in this one, you know, like the Chinatown gangs and, you know, Hyde's crew, and, you know, you'll get a lot more of the way, you know, the city works. And, you know, one of the goals of that was to, you know, even though it's a nameless, you know, fictional city, I want to make sure it feels like I want it to feel like your city. I want it to feel like New York. I want it to feel like every city. I want people who read this book to be able to, like, see their own experiences, you know, in their cities at this point in American history, kind of in this story, because that's a lot of what it's about, is about, you know, the sort of underground economy and the way, you know, bits and pieces of our country are sort of falling apart, like, you know, like Detroit or something.
Absolutely.
You know, whole areas in Detroit where, like, there's no utilities and the cops won't even go, and, you know, it's like, I want to get into that a little bit with, you know, with just from my own personal experience here in Seattle, sort of watching, you know, the city sort of struggling in this time right now to, you know, figure out how the hell to, you know, keep violent crime under control. And so there's a lot of different sort of themes going on in this story. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, it might be the most ambitious of all of them so far, which, you know, hopefully I won't fail, but, you know, some writer said that every book is a failure. It's just, you know, that you try to fail a little bit less than the previous time.
Well, and as far as the city that I see when I read Criminal, I can't help but think of San Francisco, and I know half of it is because I know you're from there, but it just,
yeah.
it feels like that kind of city. But
it's real, in my mind, it's kind of a combination between San Francisco and Chicago and New York with the sort of architecture of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's areas of all of them, but, you know, it's West Coast for sure, so it definitely does have that San Francisco feel.
And we're gonna see a lot more of the undertow, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there's some undertow in there.
Good.
We'll get to see Gnarly again.
Good.
And, you know, and Angie, the girl that he adopted in Coward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little bits and pieces of it. It's really, I didn't realize when I was setting out to do it, I thought, well, I'm going to do, it's like a procedural story. And then I realized, well, the first Lawless was a little bit of a procedural, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't realize it was a bit of a detective story, because he was trying to figure out who killed his brother. He just did it by beating the crap out of everybody and terrifying people. So this is another, like, it's a bit of a murder mystery story that Tracy, because he's such a pain in the ass to Mr. Hyde, is assigned a task to settle his deal, where he basically is told, you know, like, hey, some people who shouldn't be fucked with are getting killed, you know, like, high up, you know, like, criminals in the city who, you know, someone should have to get Mr. Hyde or someone else's permission to, like, whack these guys. And, you know, in the course of 2.5 weeks, three of them have been killed. And so, you know, Mr. Hyde is like, we don't know what's going on. We don't know if there's another crew moving into town. We don't know, you know, what the deal is, but, you know, this is your job. You're going to find out what the fuck is going on in my city. And, you know, so that's really where the plot sort of kicks into high gear, is Tracy trying to figure out what the hell is going on in the city.
Do you...
What were you saying?
No, no, go ahead. So...
Oh, it really sets it up so that, you know, even more than the previous, you know, Tracy story, we get to, you know, he's sort of our guide through the various, you know, nooks and crannies of the underworld of the city. So it's really... You know, and that's, you know, I think going to be a lot of fun.
I wonder, too, if, and I know you said you were thinking about having Leo start, or the new arc be about Leo again. But,
yeah.
And I think people maybe thought after reading the first arc that Leo was going to be our main character. And now it does seem like Tracy is kind of taking some of that focus. Is that an organic thing, or just dependent on, obviously, what story you want to tell? And again,
yeah, it's both organic and what I want to tell.
Okay.
It's, you know, the original plan was, you know, do Coward, do Lawless, do the sequel to Coward, do Bad Night, do, you know, the sequel to Law. Like, I'm sort of following a rough outline for the stuff I wrote for myself. Like, okay, this is the order that I'll tell the stories in. And then, but as I go along, like, other, you know, when I was working on Lawless, like, suddenly I had this idea to do three short stories and relaunch the book with, you know, a new format and
mm-hmm.
expand it, and, you know, and that became, you know, the thing that I had the most burning desire to do. And I feel like the way Sean and I have become as collaborators, we have, you know, between Sleeper, Criminal, Incognito, and now we're back to Criminal, it's like we've been working together for, you know, a long time now. And I think, I hope at least, that part of the fan base is there to see what we do next and not as much just, oh, I only like Criminal, or I only like Incognito, or I only like, you know. I hope they're there just because they're fans of us, or at least, you know, a portion of them are. So part of it is feeling that freedom of, we've been working together for a long time, and, you know, I should write the thing that's, you know, burning its way to the forefront at that moment. And, you know, that's kind of how I do it. It's like, you know, I wasn't originally planning to do Incognito, and then I was, you know, working on Bad Night, and I just halfway through I was like, you know, it'd be really cool to take a break from Criminal for a little while and do something that was a little bit more, you know, just kind of black comedy and, you know, weird and more violent and, you know, not so much, you know, dragged from, you know, my own life necessarily. And it really just, you know, and it was a good thing to do, I think, to take, you know, a break like that too, because it, you know, you'll see when you see Sean's art for this, it's after, you know, all the crazy shit he drew in Incognito, like coming back to Criminal, his art looks better than ever, I think, actually. And I thought even just in Incognito, he was doing stuff that was better than, you know, I'd seen anything of his before, just experimenting around with the page layouts and the way he was doing panel borders and word balloons and stuff. Like, I really felt like, you know, even though it doesn't look radically different than what he was doing before, I think just being able to try something different really helps, you know, keep your creative juices going. So, you know, that's the current plan, is to keep, you know, coming back to Criminal and, you know, and alternating between that. And, you know, right now we're going to do another Incognito story after we finish this Criminal story, and then we'll do another Criminal story, and then we'll either do, you know, we'll either stick with Criminal for a little while longer or do something else. Like, I've got like a sci-fi idea I want to do maybe. And, you know, the hope is that, you know, we've created a big enough fan base for our stuff that they'll keep, you know, supporting what we do.
Whereas,
I always jokingly say that we're reader supported. We're like PBS. Except without the radio, without the phone drives,
without the tote bags. Yeah, without the tote bags too.
Yeah, without the tote bags. Yeah, we need tote bags. That's what we need.
Is well, and that's good, because I was wondering. I just interviewed Brian Azzarello, and we were talking about, you know, living with 100 bullets as long as he did, and he immediately said, "Yeah, that's nothing." Eduardo is the guy to talk to about that, because, you know, and I would say the same must be true for Sean. So it is good that you're able to switch up and really keep him engaged and interested to, you know, keep wanting to do this, because it does come out in the books. And I do see what you're saying about Incognito. There are definite differences there.
And even
faces.
Val, I got to try some different stuff with coloring Sean. And, you know, some of that stuff, you know, he's bringing back to Criminal, even though, you know, the coloring styles that he uses on those two books couldn't be more different, as far as the, you know, I mean, Incognito was much more vibrant than what he does in Criminal, but, you know, we talked about it, and it was like, well, some of the stuff you were doing, some of the effects and some of the color palette stuff, you should try to bring back to Criminal, actually. And, you know, like, it might look cool, actually, to kind of blend those styles. And, you know, I really, it's true what you're saying, though, about the artist, like, because really this is all Sean does is work for me now.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, same thing, you know, for years, Michael Lark was pointing that out to me and Greg when we were working on Gotham Central. You know, I was like, well, look, you guys get to go off and write three other comics this month. This is all I'm doing.
Sure.
You know, so that was, you know, that is something you've really got to think about.
Well, and maybe this isn't an opportunity then to switch to Incognito and point out a great wrap up. And you know, it. I do you want to keep these worlds separate, Ed? Because again, I know the team is there, but I mean, I don't know, because I'm enjoying them both. I really am, and I don't know. I don't know where the line is in your mind
in
terms of...
Yeah, believe me, with the way the sales were on Incognito, I considered making it a flip book with Criminal and just putting it out bi-monthly.
Really? Was it lower? What, really? People didn't respond to Incognito the way they did to Criminal?
No, they did.
Good.
You know, they sold better.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we sold like about 25% better than we were on Criminal. And,
interesting.
And, you know, I think part of it was, you know, obviously there's a mask on the cover, but part of it was... Criminal had been around for a few years, and if you didn't get it at the beginning, you know, you were probably going to wait for trade. So hearing that we had a new project, you know, gave people a chance to, like, get on to the you know, the number one. And that's, you know, that's why I didn't go back to the numbering on Criminal, because I was like, well, shit, we're selling, you know, a ton of Incognito, and, you know, I'm hoping that at least some of those people are going to follow us back to Criminal who weren't previously buying Criminal. So... You know, it's doubtful that they will pick up Criminal issue 8 or 18, but they will probably, you know, be more likely to pick up a number one.
Well, and that's fine, and I really wish the rest of mainstream comics would follow suit, because honestly, the numbering is just so meaningless at this point, and why not just be whatever the story arc is, incorporate that in the title and in the banner of the book, and and every start of a new arc should be a new number one.
Yeah, why not? I mean, the numbers, I think originally are just to keep track of it, you know. It's not supposed to mean anything marketing-wise, you know. It's like, oh, I didn't get issue, you know, 747. And, you know, like, that's the only, you know, and that's the only way I use numbering at all. I don't care what, you know, what number some book is when I'm buying it. I just want to make sure I didn't miss any.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I feel like, you know, especially if we're going to be alternating between doing Criminal and doing other kinds of stories and other properties that we're creating, like, I feel like, you know, we'll, you know, it's the Hellboy model in a way, and, you know, it seems to have done well for Mike Mignola.
Sure. I want to stay on Criminal because I do have a few more questions, and especially with this coming up, is when you research for your unnamed city, Are you looking at the real, you know, stories of very specific cities, and are you finding the hidden stories that the average person may not know about in terms of, you know, the way underworld business is being done in a certain city or whatever?
You know, I read all kinds of crime nonfiction about stuff like that. I don't specifically take anything from, you know, any specific. I'll use anything that sounds cool, basically.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, a lot of the crime organization, you know, that we have in Criminal is actually based on, you know, the Chicago Outfit. So, you know, the way that they ran more like a corporation. That's why Mr. Hyde isn't, you know, the mafia. You know, because it's not about what, you know, what race you are or what community you belong to. It's about, you know, running your business like a business. Your business just happens to be crime, stuff like that. And,
okay.
You know, I try to sort of, I mean, it's whenever you live in any city, you know, you kind of, especially as a writer, you kind of, you know, follow whatever's going on in your city. So, you know, that is, you know, I should probably start using a lot more San Francisco stuff, just because it is the city that I know the most about, as far as, you know, having lived there for a really long time and seen a lot of crime there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's kind of an instinctual thing. I mean, a lot of the heists and stuff like that we have in the book are, you know, either loosely based on real crimes or crimes that I thought of while walking around the cities looking at things. Like I owe Dwayne Swierczynski a big tip of the hat, actually, for the escape for when they break the heist planner in Lawless out.
Uh-huh.
That's actually how Dwayne wrote a book called This Is a Stick Up, or This Here's a Stick Up, I think it's called. And it's a book about, yeah, This Here's a Stick Up. It's an American bank robbery encyclopedia, basically. And in his intro, he interviewed this guy who was the leader of the Stopwatch Gang, and that's the gang that what's his name? Patrick Swayze his gang in Point Break is based on the Stopwatch Gang. Actually.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was a real. They dressed up with dead presidents, or not dead presidents, but they dressed up in you know, ex-presidents' masks and used stopwatches and you know, dressed in suits and stuff and went in and robbed banks. And, you know, the stopwatch was because they needed to know exactly how long they were in the bank, and they left immediately after, like, 2.5 minutes in or something. And but the guy who ran that group was a Canadian bank robber, and he was in a prison in Canada. He got arrested, and his gang broke him out of prison by, he faked a heart attack by taking a bunch of drugs, and they hijacked the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And so I was like, oh, that's a great one. That's a great thing. I'll steal that.
I always love the stopwatch motif, especially in crime movies, because it just adds to the tension.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, even in Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah. Did you see, they released it on video last year, the Dustin Hoffman movie, Straight Time?
No.
Oh, you've got to see that. It's based on the book by Eddie Bunker, No Beast So Fierce. He's the guy who was, I think, not Mr. Brown. I can't remember what color he was in Reservoir Dogs. He's the guy who... He was an actual thief, bank robber, and criminal who wrote a book about it while he was in prison. And he was actually in prison when the movie got released, even though he was in the movie in Straight Time. But he was also in Reservoir Dogs. He was one of the crew who doesn't have any dialogue. He's like the older guy with the long hair and the mustache.
Oh, okay.
He was a famous, like, actual criminal and novelist. And the movie Straight Time is based on the book he wrote in the early 70s, actually, or maybe even the late 60s. And Dustin Hoffman optioned it, and it's really good, actually. It's him and Harry Dean Stanton are bank robbers. God, who else is in it? It's Gary Busey.
Oh, wow.
As, like, a junkie bank robber. Yeah, it's really cool. It's got the most accurate, realistic bank robbery of all time in it, apparently.
Oh, that's really cool. You
know, yeah, and Hoffman apparently was so into the property that he spent like 6 months hanging out with Eddie Bunker and all of his friends. And like all of his friends were all, you know, professional thieves and badasses. And so, like, in one of the interviews with Eddie Bunker that I read about it, he said, you know, Hoffman came this close to actually going out with them and pulling a score just, he realized at that point, you know, I might be crossing a line here. But it gave me a renewed respect for Hoffman, but, you know, it's the mid-70s Hoffman.
So exactly. Yeah, he's not dancing. He's not dancing with Emma Thompson at this point or running the Wonderful Emporium at this point.
Yeah, or that one with the monkey virus.
Oh, Outbreak. Now, you see, I've heard people, like, defend Outbreak and say that's the closest you're ever going to see to Dustin Hoffman being an action hero.
It probably is.
Yeah, well, you know. Now, that's good, man. No, I have to look for Straight Time now.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Is it on Criterion? What's it on?
I don't know. I think it's just a regular video release.
All right.
On Criterion.
All right, I'll definitely be searching for that.
That came out right around the same time they released that old Elliot Gould movie, The Silent Partner.
Love that. Curtis Hanson movie.
Yeah,
excellent
Curtis
movie.
Hanson.
Oh.
Yeah.
God, I was
filmed in Montreal, and it actually takes place there.
I remember seeing that movie in the very early VHS days.
Wow. Yeah, it was one of the first things I saw on HBO when we got it, I recall, in like 7th or 8th grade. That movie was on.
Very cool.
And it terrified me, and then I watched it again last year when it got released, and I'm like, this movie's not scary at all. Like, stuff about it that just horrified me when I was like 13 was like nothing. Now I'm like, really? I thought he totally decapitated this woman. That's not it at all.
And a very young John Candy in that movie.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah,
which is awesome.
Yeah,
like pre SC or if or around the time of SCTV. I mean, he's got long blonde hair in that movie.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
No, I love that movie. That's fantastic. Well, this is good. You know, I just talked to Patton Oswalt and was bringing up his essay of on Blast for Silence. Which, of course, was one of the criminal essays. Now, as we're talking, can you tease any of the coming essays that we'll be seeing in the new arc?
I'm not sure offhand. I mean, I know my first one is in the first issue I'm writing, a piece about three Peter Yates movies, touching briefly on Bullet, but talking mostly about the movie he did that got him the job for Bullet, Robbery,
Okay.
Which is based on the Great Train Robbery in England, that has, I think, a better car chase than is in Bullet, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, because, you know, they don't have the same restrictions in England that they had in America.
True.
You can nearly run people over, apparently, in your car chases.
Who was in Robbery?
No one you'd have heard of, really. It's
okay.
Like a bunch of, you know, British character actors in the late 60s. But it's the movie Steve McQueen saw the opening 15 minutes of it and said, hire this guy. And then the Friends of Eddie Coyle, which just came out on Criterion a couple months ago.
God, I love that movie.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it ever. And,
wow.
It just blew me away. Yeah, it was just not, for some reason, not on my radar. But Rucka talked about it at one point. I looked for it, and it wasn't available on DVD. And I didn't have a VHS player, so I was like,
AMC.
And then Criterion put it out, and it's such a nice edition.
Oh, that's good to know, because, yeah, AMC has been running the hell out of it lately.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's fantastic.
Yeah,
and
that's probably why they're trying to get their money's worth before everybody buys the DVD.
Now, and I'm blanking, because, and the guy's name is always on the tip.
Robert Mitchum.
Thank you, it's Mitchum, yes.
Yeah, Mitchum and Peter Boyle.
Yes.
And, the guy who played Francis in Logan's Run is in it too, as the sleazy cop, which is great because he actually right after that, him and Mitchum went and made the Yakuza, which
Mike
Stratford, our producer for Angel of Death, wrote an article about. But the two of them played like a father and son type in that movie, kind of where Mitchum was actually mentoring this guy. So it's really weird. I watched those movies like almost back to back recently, and I was like, whoa, this is weird. I didn't know that this guy was in both movies.
Yeah, I didn't put that together either. I've seen both films. And
yeah,
I loved that decade of Robert Mitchum's work because, I mean, he's, Out of the Past and Night of the Hunter and all those wonderful films from the 40s and the 50s and even through the 60s. But the 70s, really interesting stuff that he was doing.
Yeah, he made some really cool things. I really do think that Friends of Eddie Coyle might be his best performance, like maybe of his entire career.
I wouldn't disagree. Yeah, I
love him so much in the stuff in the 40s and the 50s, but it's such a quiet performance for him.
Yeah, and very much a character role, unlike the others, where he was kind of in that same Hollywood way, where Jimmy Stewart couldn't help but be Jimmy Stewart in every role that he was in.
Yeah, exactly.
But Eddie Coyle, Mitchum really does assume this South Boston kind of character.
Yeah, he really became that guy, and apparently they offered him the Peter Boyle role first, which, arguably might be the better part. Even though it's not the title of the, you're not in the title of the movie, but Peter Boyle might have more screen time than him actually, and he definitely I don't want to spoil the movie for anybody, but he's got a really great role in that, and Mitchum preferred, I guess they thought that would be a more natural part for him because he's more vicious character kind of, but whereas Eddie Coyle is kind of a sad sack.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and a really interesting character, like a sad sack who's also kind of a tough guy who's been like a crook his whole life. Like he's just one of those guys who's like connected. He's like a lifelong bag man, basically.
No, well, that's the thing, and I would say fans of Criminal, and this is one of the great things about buying Criminal Monthly. You get essays like that do further educate your love of the genre and will lead you to films and books and magazines that, the average person who is just now coming to this genre through Criminal will really get excited and find more like-minded things to watch and read.
Yeah, yeah. It's become a really popular part of the thing. And, that's why I always refer to Criminal as a crime magazine. And it's like we serialize our comics in it, but, there's this whole other part to it that's a magazine, actually. And, that's why it's got to be so fucking long every time that it kills me. But, and also in issue one, we're printing excerpts from this long interview that Darwin Cook and Tom Spurgeon and I did about his Parker graphic novel. So I'm sort of taking a couple sections of that and putting that out there because probably a lot of people didn't see that online.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so that'll be, we'll have a couple features in every one. And I know... I think Stephen Grant and Dwayne Swarzynski and a couple other people have already told me they're writing articles for the new run. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, it's at this point now, it's like, because I always joke it pays nothing but street cred, but it really does. And but more and more people are you know, they like being part of it. So it's really cool that, you know, the book has become this sort of weird cult thing that, you know, like people who work for, you know, like crime writers and screenwriters and, you know, people who work for crime magazines and stuff have basically been like, I'll write an article for you. So, yeah, it's really cool.
That's excellent, man. And I know I was asking Patton if he knew if his essay on Blast of Silence was going to be in the omnibus. And,
oh, yeah.
And he's like, oh, I hope so. And he really was, like,
oh,
excited about it. Yeah, well.
He told me.
Well,
yeah, I didn't print. I only printed my own articles in the omnibus because I just feel like, you know, I don't really own those articles. Everybody just kind of does them as a favor for me.
Okay.
But ultimately, someday when I get enough material together, I'd like to put together a big book and maybe, you know, I don't know, publish it through Marvel or publish it through, you know, like a crime book publisher, maybe like Hard Case or somebody, like put out a big, like a nice art book with all those articles and call it like The Criminal Guide to Noir.
Sure.
You know, and but it needs to be a couple hundred pages worth of material. And at this point, we're still, you know, not quite at that level. I need at least a few more years of material, but I feel weird about those articles because I love them and I love them being part of the, you know, the book, the comics, you know, but I also, you know, want to make sure that I do right by all those people. Like if I started reprinting them, like for the trade paper, like I wouldn't put them in the trade paperbacks because they wouldn't make any sense there. But if I started putting them even in the omnibus, like I would feel like I was ripping off my friends.
I understand.
You know, even though, you know, they probably wouldn't care, like, part of me would feel like I was using their stuff, you know, more than I had really asked for, you know. And so hopefully, you know, we'll be able to put this book together someday, and then I'll actually be able to pay them for their material.
Well, that'd be great because, yeah, I mean, we've seen it now in Criminal and also Incognito as well. Jess Nevins did an equally great job on those.
Did you read Jess's article in the new one?
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, it looks pretty, and you know, let's talk about that for a second, because Incognito in chapter 6 we saw a lot of fleshed out a lot more characters that seem to be part of this pulp genre that I was certainly unaware of, the Zeppelin pulps.
The Zeppelin pulps.
Who the hell knew?
Yeah, who knew? I don't know whether I should perpetuate this or not.
Well, it was, and certainly I can't deny with the Marvels project coming out, it was interesting how it all seemed to dovetail back to a very specific era and an interesting grouping of characters.
Well, and that's really interesting because that's where it kind of, you know, that's part of where the world of Incognito grew from for me was trying to imagine, you know, and this isn't a new thing. This is kind of what Alan Moore was doing with the ABC line was he was, at least with Tom Strong, you know, trying to imagine what would a superhero be, you know, if superheroes had never veered away from the pulps, you know, like when, you know, because when superheroes first started out, they were much closer to the pulp roots that they
of
were
course.
At. And, you know, so that was part of it, was thinking, okay, well, what if, you know, what would my sort of noir pulp universe be? Like, who would these characters be? What would they be, you know, what would they have evolved from, and what would they be like? And also trying to take those two staples of, you know, the sort of big apocalyptic Doc Savage-like world and tell sort of a fucked up dark noir story in it. You know, it's like, well, nobody's ever tried to sort of take Black Mask and Doc Savage and jam them into one book. So you've got your main character who's this fucked up henchman living in witness protection, you know. So that was sort of where it spun out of. But a lot of it was just, I mean, you know, you saw was it last issue 5 that showed the origin of the universe?
Yes.
But their world, which was, you know, obviously a nod to Philip Jose Farmer.
And Wold Newton.
And his Wold Newton, you know, thing with the you know, I just try to keep it vague.
Sure.
Because
well,
it's like I'm making these really obvious nods. But yeah, a lot of that came into play in you know, researching for the Marvels project. I started thinking about this because, you know, the Angel and Kazar actually started out in one of Martin Goodman's pulp magazines.
Absolutely.
And they were the only two characters to come over from the pulps to, you know, Marvel Comics. But Yeah, so, yeah, Jess's article about the Zeppelin pulps, though, I thought was really fascinating that he'd stumbled across my secret.
Well, yeah, and there are characters that ultimately, they were published by a different publisher, but ultimately Goodman kind of gained possession of the existing material. I mean, I don't know. You explain it better. I don't know. Or don't.
I don't know how far to take it.
All right.
I don't know how much I should explain or not.
All right, well,
people should just read the article.
Exactly.
And find out, you know. But I do own all these characters.
Good.
They are not public domain. I just want that known.
Okay.
My favorite name of any character in that article, though, is, of course, one of Professor Zeppelin's lead villains from the 30s pulps is Pontius Pilate.
Yes.
the German flyer.
I know. That was excellent. I like
that.
Yeah,
that was a favorite. But, that was sort of the key, was trying to, you know, figure out what your pulp universe would grow from, thinking in terms of, you know, what if there had been this enormously popular, you know, genre of pulp fiction for, you know, a year, because pulp magazines came and went. Like, Jeff and I were talking about this, and there are certain pulp magazines that there's only one copy in existence that's even known of, and there's others that are legendary, but no one's ever seen a copy, like, in any time in the last 50 years, you know, because, you know, the stuff was pulped.
Sure.
People threw this stuff away. It wasn't, you know, and then the war came. And
right, with all the paper drives.
And
absolutely.
Stuff. And, you know, it's the reason certain early comics are so rare.
Yes.
But, yeah, so, you know, the idea that there was this huge genre of pulps that were, you know, because there were so many different genres of pulps that were popular, that some would flare up for a year and then disappear. And you know, the idea that there was this really popular kind of pulp magazine that sprung all sorts of different, you know, Zeppelin pulps all over the place, and then the Hindenburg crashes and the entire genre sort of goes away. I love his comment about Professor Zeppelin riding a motorcycle. Picture Professor Zeppelin just kind of riding around on like a, you know, 40s era, you know, Indian,
sure,
or something. I just thought that was really funny.
Also just pointing out that Professor Zeppelin really did take a lot from Doc Savage, and that kind of was the tradition of the pulps, was, you know, somebody comes up with one good idea, and then every other publishing company immediately jumps on and does their variation.
You know, Superman and then,
yep,
Captain Marvel.
Absolutely, and Wonder Man, for that matter, the one that Will Eisner was commissioned to do. And,
oh, is that what it was called, Wonder Man? I was wondering about that. I was thinking about that just yesterday when I was reading the article about how the Iger who runs Disney is actually related to the Iger from Eisner and Iger.
I didn't know that Bob Iger and Jerry Iger are related. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was in an article yesterday. It was pointing out that he's the great grandnephew of Jerry Iger.
Crazy.
Which is funny that he took over from, you know, like, who was it? Eisner, who was Bob Eisner? No, who was the Eisner who ran Disney before?
Oh, Michael Eisner.
Michael Eisner, yeah, who I'm like, is not apparently related to Will Eisner, but you know, Iger, so it's like weird, Iger and Eisner, so it's like, wow, how strange.
Yeah, it all
he's actually got, you know, some comic book cred in his family, at least.
That's funny. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, you're not in the boardroom or anything like that, but any thoughts on the acquisition?
Well, I hope, you know, everything we've been told is, you know, what you've seen in those articles, which is that it is modeled after the same, you know, arrangement that they made with Pixar when they merged with Pixar or bought Pixar, whichever you know. But, I mean, of course, John Lasseter ended up, you know, being the head of Disney Animation in that deal. I don't think Joe Quesada is moving into, you know, running Disney Film or anything anytime, you know, but... But, no, it sounds like, you know, it's going to be business as usual for Marvel, but just with the backing of, you know, one of the largest corporations in the world.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I mean, the hope is that it will help, you know, my hope is that it, you know, in the same way that Warner Brothers, you know, various muscle seems to be able to get DC books into a lot of different places that I don't see in a lot of my books, is that, you know, Disney's, you know, various, you know, distribution arms will get our product out to a lot more places. And I think that's the plan, kind of. I don't think Disney would have wanted in on the deal if they didn't see, you know, like, look, these guys are already making a ton of money, and they're not even, you know, in all these places where we could put them. You know, I mean, the fact is, Marvel didn't need to sell, and, you know, Marvel was one of only two stocks, according to, you know, stock report at the end of last year. Marvel was one of only two stocks that ended the year up instead of down. And, you know, Marvel is a highly profitable company, even just on the publishing side. So it's not like, you know, they need some giant corporation to sort of be their, you know, be their backing, and, you know, so they can, you know, which is, I saw some people online speculating that now Marvel could take more risks and be more, you know, like they could have their own Vertigo and, you know, have these loss leaders, and it's like, I don't see Marvel doing that, you know, like,
okay.
I don't see Marvel turning around and suddenly being like, we're going to start publishing a bunch of books that don't sell, you know, no offense to Vertigo, I buy a ton of Vertigo books, but, you know, Warner Brothers has been, you know, when they sold their entire, you know, publishing department to, like, an Italian company, like, they didn't consider DC Comics to be part of it. They, you know, they considered, I think they write DC off in their R&D or something.
Right.
And, you know, I don't see that being, you know, the deal here with Marvel and Disney. Like, A, Marvel doesn't need it, and, you know, I don't think they would have made the deal if they thought that Disney was just going to come in and, like, start hacking up the place. And, you know, I you know, from what I was told, there were, you know, a lot of meetings about it, and, you know, it was kept very, very hush-hush, but everybody there is really confident that it's going to be a good thing, and, you know, I trust all the people who I work with there, you know, and all of them are really excited about it, so, you know.
So, and so then, really, the Icon line in general, there's no fear of that going away? I mean, because people are always confused by what Icon represents. I always say, just based on my conversations with you and Bendis and the others that are able to participate in it, that it seems to be very specifically an employee perk for you guys to do your own thing. Well, no, and I don't mean that, in a condescending way, you know what I mean?
To a certain degree, yeah. I mean, it helps. You know, I mean, for me, it keeps me happy doing the stuff that I don't own to have stuff that comes out that I do.
Yes.
But also, you know, I mean, you get to publish your book. It's a creator-driven line more than anything. It's not, there isn't an editorial vision over the whole line like there is with, you know, Vertigo, for example. You know, it's based, it's project-based and creator-based, and it really depends on your relationship with Marvel. And, you know, I mean, Marvel doesn't make a lot of money on the stuff. They, you know, it's not like they don't make anything on our books, but, you know, it's very much done to sort of, you know, keep us happy and help us, you know, be able to create this work that's published by, you know, the biggest publisher in comics.
Okay.
In America, at least. And, you know, it's, you know, I, you know, every time I'm turning in one of my books, I'm, like, completely thankful that I get to publish there, so... You know, I can't imagine what my life would be like if I didn't get to publish books through Icon at this point, just because I've been doing it for, you know, the last 3-something years, it seems like. And, you know, I mean, hell, the last year or two, I've been putting out more stuff through Icon than anybody, I think. But yeah, that's why it's kind of cool, too, is that, you know, sometimes you're the only thing coming out from Icon that month.
Sure.
There's not, like, 9 or 10 other things, so your thing isn't just, you know, a drop in the bucket. So you really, even while you're, you know, one of 70 pages in a Marvel catalog, you might be the only thing that's like that they're publishing that month. And Marvel books are carried by a lot of stores that don't carry, you know, other stuff.
I'm aware of that.
Like, I know for a fact I get into stores that I wouldn't have gotten into if I were self-publishing this or putting it out through a smaller publisher, you know, and it's just, you know, it's a good deal.
I hope that the Disney, you know, deal allows even further distribution of Icon.
Yeah, me too, because, you know they do, I would assume that they're, you know, going to want to, if they do get a percentage of, you know, whatever we make, they'll, you know, hopefully want their percentage to be bigger.
Cool.
Or to, you know, not be a bigger percentage, but to be more money.
I understand. Is
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the one, you know, thing we'll wait and see. I mean, all contracts are what they are, but, you know, already, you know, the Icon line is something that is very clearly, you know, done for us. It's done for the creators. It's
yes.
done for, you know, and it's done for, it's, you know, this is something I've spoken about with people at Marvel, too, like, that are high up there, is that, you know, just like taking a break from Criminal to go do Incognito sort of recharges my batteries, you know, and Sean's batteries, being able to turn around and do, you know, Criminal at all, or do Incognito, or do Powers, or, you know, Kick-Ass, you know, any of that stuff.
Sure.
It makes doing Captain America or the Marvels project or any of that stuff that much better, you know, because it's just like, okay, I got to do this other weird thing, you know, and now it adds different perspectives to what you're doing.
It's the best of both worlds. I mean,
yeah,
you're,
it really is.
You're playing with the corporate toys and you're getting to do your own thing as well.
Yeah, exactly. It really plays off, I think.
That's excellent, man. And I can see that it clearly does, because I really think you are enjoying a very special creative time right now, where I'm enjoying everything that you're writing, and I'm thrilled to, you know, every time, whether it's Captain America or now the Marvels project or Criminal or Incognito, it's like, yay, new Brubaker. So I'm certainly happy, and I know a lot of other people are as well and are intrigued by the changes in Captain America that are going on right now, and maybe it's good point to talk about Reborn. 600 was interesting because obviously there's tons of stories still to be told with all the introductions that you laid out there in 600.
Yeah. The Nomad one was, or the well, I guess it's been revealed that the Bucky from
Onslaught from Heroes Reborn.
Heroes Reborn, yeah. I was going to say, is it Reborn? Yeah. I'm like, wait, I'm doing Reborn. the Bucky from the Heroes Reborn, Onslaught Reborn, is, you know, obviously becoming the new Nomad, and that was, so I really wanted to tease that, because that was something we came up with at one of the recent summits, you know, and I had promised Loeb that I would put her in the comic at some point, and then, you know, we were kicking around, and we were trying to figure out, you know, what should happen with the Nomad name, and I was like, you know, you should have Girl Bucky become Nomad, and then Fraction was like, Nomad, Girl Without a World, and it was just like, oh my God, and Loeb was out of the room when it happened. He walked back in, and I was like, Nomad, Girl Without a World, and he's like, I love it. So, yeah, he's like, I leave the room, and it gets solved, and I'm like, yeah, we talked about it when you weren't here, so you wouldn't argue.
And McKeever's taking that book. Are you working in concert with Sean then?
No, I haven't been in touch with them about it at all, but I'm glad that they got him to do that, because I like his stuff a lot, and I'm glad to see him back working for Marvel doing stuff. There is some stuff about that that I know that I'm not sure I can talk about, so I'm going to have to skip it. But yeah, I think it'll be a really cool thing for, you know, using the Nomad name and with a girl who's got the Captain America connection, and, you know, using that to sort of figure out who she is, which is what Captain America originally used it for. It was like, well, who am I then?
Yes.
And that's kind of cool. So I'm really psyched to see that. But yeah, and then there's the Cap from the 50s.
Yes.
Saw a little bit of him, and that's the next storyline that starts in Cap 602 begins, you know, getting to see what's gone on with him from that point.
That's cool. I loved reading, and first of all, I always loved seeing Howard Chaykin's art, and was very happy that he did that section. Loved his Theater of War focus on 50s Cap as well.
Yeah, and I think he's got some other plans in the works for some 50s-era Marvel stuff, maybe.
I'm not sure
if that's going to happen or not, but I know he was talking about some project that sounded really cool.
I'm just happy Dominic Fortune's back, man, in the Maximum.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that cool?
I just saw him in Chicago right before the book came out, and, yeah, I mean, I know he was shocked to get the call and say, no, we want more, and it's like he shrugged and is like, all right, I got plenty to say. And that's, I mean, there's a character that's been sitting really for almost 30 years in terms
of,
you know.
Fraction and I were always talking about using him, trying to figure out how to use him in the modern era, and I know I was tempted to go hunt down the first issues of the Scorpion through online. I was looking after I saw the Dominic Fortune. I'm like, you know, I haven't read those like since I was a little kid. Like, I think I found them used at like a bookstore in like 1980 or something like that.
Sure.
But yeah, that, I love that he just renamed the character and just took him over to Marvel.
Exactly. Yeah, it was Atlas, and it was the 70s Atlas.
Yeah, and he was the Scorpion, who was basically a spider knockoff.
Yes, the pulp spider. Absolutely.
Yeah, the pulp spider. Yeah, Chaykin is, you know, it's funny, you don't realize how influenced you are by Chaykin until you like look up one day and you're like, oh yeah, Chaykin did stuff like this.
And back to Cap 600, because we saw Bernie, is it Rothstein? I forget her last name. Is it Rosenstein?
Oh, yeah.
Rosenberg? Bernie Rosenberg?
Bernie Rosenberg, yeah.
Rosenberg, okay. Will Bernie and some of the other people like that be coming back in the story?
Not so much. That was something, they wanted extra stuff in the back, and they told me, you know, they were going to have Wade write something, and then Roger Stern, and they... I can't remember whether I suggested Roger do something about Bernie, or I might have suggested it just because it was like, well, she was his character, you know, and we haven't seen her in the book for a while. Like, maybe he should do something about her because it's the anniversary of Cap's death. And
sure.
Like, I might have suggested. I think I did, but I'm not 100% sure, so don't take my word for it, internet world.
No problem.
I've gotten some... We've emailed back and forth a bit, Roger Stern and I, because I really liked that story, and he did a Bucky and the Young Allies special.
Yes.
That was very much in the kind of vein of the stuff that I've done with you know, A, with Bucky, and B, with looking back at the comics from the 40s and trying to integrate them into, you know, a more realistic take on these characters. Like, I loved what he did with that, with having them actually be soldiers that Bucky ended up, you know, working with, and, you know, he goes to a VA hospital to see them and they're old men. Like, that was just classic.
I agree.
Yeah, and, you know, he's just so great. He's a guy who's never really, you know, lost his game, and, you know, I hope he starts to get a lot more work.
I completely agree, and
he was pretty much my favorite, you know, as a kid. I think I think Steve Englehart was probably one of my favorites early on, and then Roger Stern sort of, you know, followed up on that.
Certainly, and both on Captain America, incredible runs.
Yeah, he did a great run on Spider-Man too.
Great run on Spider-Man. Great run on Superman. No, I think in a lot of ways, Roger is one of the unsung prolific writers of his time. That really, when you step back and see the body of work, you realize how many great stories he truly wrote.
Yeah, and they sent me his scripts, too, to look at, and he scripts in this weird hybrid of full script and Marvel style, so it's really interesting.
Oh, that's cool.
He doesn't have all of his dialogue or narration figured out, but he has parts of it, so he sort of tells you what's being said or what the stories are about.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to get him on a word balloon, and Englehart has a couple novel projects that aren't coming out until next year. And in 2010, I'll have Steve back because he thought a couple of them were going to come out in 2009, and we were close to doing an interview. And he said, oh, they push it till next year if you don't mind waiting. And I'm like, hey, man, whenever you want to talk. I'm like, I'm happy to have you back because, no, Steve, man, between his work on Cap and Batman, I'm a big fan of Steve's stuff. Not to mention Doctor Strange and all the others.
Steve Englehart. Wait. Sorry, I'm like, wait, you switched from Roger Stern to Steve Englehart. Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah, you know, I read his book, which, you know, when I was like 11 or 12, I was at the comic convention in San Diego, and I'd been going to that thing since I was like 8 years old or something, and I remember meeting Steve Englehart when he published his book, The Point Man.
Yes.
Which, you know, was about the DJ who was like a Vietnam vet, and it was like some sort of a weird modern fantasy horror thing. And he sold me that book. I was like 10 years old, 11 years old. It's totally not a book for kids. I remember meeting him, and I think he was sitting with Jim Starlin, actually, and talking about something, and I came up and was telling him what a big fan of his Captain America I was, and he was like, well, you should buy my novel. And he had, like, copies of The Point Man sitting on it. I was like, you wrote a novel? And I remember reading it, and it was one of the first novels that I ever read, I think, like, as a kid.
Because okay.
I was, like, you know, the first one that wasn't, like, a young adult novel.
Sure.
It was like, here I go from reading Encyclopedia Brown to reading, you know. I remember the guy's name, too. He was a DJ named Barnaby Wild. which is like the worst name for a DJ ever.
Hey, this is Barnaby Wilde coming to you live from K-Rock 101.
You know, it's like, you could totally see that being an actual DJ's name in the 70s.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's appropriate for the 70s, actually.
Oh, yeah,
Barnaby
totally
Wilde,
perfect
absolutely.
DJ name, actually. Like, they need to have, like, crazy names in the 70s. They always did.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, it was just funny. I have no memory of what the actual book was about. I just remember that. And that it was the point man because that was what he was in Vietnam. He was always on point.
I believe that's the next two novels, I think, go back to that character. I've got to – honestly, man, I gotta go back and reread my emails. But but back to Cap. Now, you know, I like – there are echoes in Cap Reborn of one of my favorite Cap Jack Kirby stories, and that's the Bicentennial stories.
Yeah.
And I love that because he also then was unstuck in time by different circumstances and
Isn't
relived
that
interest.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, and but I like.
Maybe Jack Kirby was watching Lost. Maybe Jack Kirby was unstuck in time and he got to see that that season of Lost.
Well, yeah. First of all, to point out that right, you know, as cool as Carlton and Damon are, they didn't invent everything. Well, and that for that matter, actually,
neither did Vonnegut.
Well, I was going to. That's what I was about to say. If anything, maybe Jack was reading Kurt Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse-5 because.
Yeah, but even Vonnegut didn't invent the Philip K. Dick did it first, and Theodore Sturgeon did it first, and it just depends on, you know, different, everybody does their own different take on it, but, yeah, I mean, Martian Time Slip is basically about how autism makes you be able to see the future.
That's very cool. Well, and
see time differently than people see it.
Well, and also the likelihood that people under our age that will go back and read that stuff, I like the idea of kind of readdressing basic ideas that may have been addressed in the past, putting a modern spin on them, and again, writing a much different story, because it is a different story. But I think that's great, because I think there are echoes of what makes a good Captain America story in Reborn, not just the places that he goes to and the events that we see him reliving, but also, again, this device that you are taking and using in a different way.
That's totally true. That Bicentennial special, though, was one of the that and like an episode of Twilight Zone were the things that made me like obsessed with time travel as a kid.
Interesting.
You know, like that, I was like, wait, Captain America fought in the Revolutionary War? No way! You know, like, and you know, and then that Twilight Zone episode where the guy gets on the train and gets off in his own childhood.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, wait, he was the one who scarred himself? Oh my God! You know, like, just seeing that when you're like 8 years old on like the Twilight Zone marathon. But those were, you know, nobody noticed that little nod. And you know, when you get to see the cover to the, I think it will be the cover or the special or a pinup inside. Brian did this great image that has like Revolutionary War stuff on it and stuff. So
fantastic.
But it was you know, part of the reason I really wanted to do the Vonnegut nod is because, you know, Vonnegut was one of the most influential writers, you know, to me. And also, you know, how perfect to, you know, to do that for a Steve Rogers story who is, you know, the super soldier. He's the quintessential Marvel World War II character, you know, even more so than Nick Fury, really. And, you know, because he was actually published as a World War II, you know, pamphlet.
Sure.
Was, you know, he was propaganda, basically.
Yes.
And to take him and you know, and put him through a kind of Slaughterhouse-5 like thing, but also, you know, knowing that it was going to be like a special event thing, it gives me that perfect chance to go back and sort of, you know, for people who haven't been long-term Captain America readers, they get to see his life story again, but from a different perspective. You know, they get to touch on these important moments in his life and sort of see why he is Captain America and who he is. So, but it was really frustrating because I'd been planning that since issue 25, and I'm a big fan of Lost, and I saw like they did the Constant episode, and I was like, damn it! And then the next season was all like they're all slipping around through time, and I was like, well, they're doing it completely differently. They're not slipping within their own bodies, and they're not, you know, the island is moving through time really, and you know, it was completely different, and I feel like, you know, all time travel stories touch on so many of the same themes and things like that. You know, you can't not do your story because some TV show did something that also uses, you know, some of the similar, you know, effects. If you're going to do a time travel story, everyone's going to be like, oh, it's just like the time traveler's wife, or it's just like this, or it's just, you know, it's like, that's, you know, nobody who writes any of those books or works on any of those things is going to be like, oh, you're ripping me off, because we all know that, you know, you know, if you're going to do a time travel story, there's really only like three things you can do.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of wish fulfillment here, specifically to Cap, though, and his relationships with his cast of characters, not only ones that, you know, we've gotten used to seeing in the modern age, but like to have the opportunity to go back and give a real modern look at the at Dr. Erskine and their relationship, and give him one more good conversation before the inevitable is going to happen.
And on top of that, to then get to see Brian Hitch draw Captain America's origin.
Yeah.
You know, like, you walk into that room and suddenly it's not just this 10x10 room with, like, a, you know, weird machine on the side. It's a fucking, you know, it's this huge fucking warehouse filled with Tesla coils exploding, and, you know, and it's just like, oh my God. Like, we always joke about how comics don't have a budget, but when Brian Hitch draws them, they do, and it's $500 million. You know, and it's like, you can almost hear Brian, his thoughts as he's drawing it. He's like, this is what the movie should look like, you know, and it's totally true. I'm like, if this isn't how it looks in the movie, they're crazy.
Well, I was wondering that, how much Marvel West is paying attention to Reborn and as they're prepping this
movie. I know they're reading the stuff. I know they're, I've talked to a couple guys there, like, before San Diego, and I know they were really interested in the Marvels project, just in general, just like looking, because it's, you know, it's the incontinuity origin of Marvel, so they're, you know, obviously very concerned about what we're doing and very interested in seeing, you know, our take on that, because, you know, obviously, you know, the guys making the movies and I come from the same generation, kind of, and we have the same basic takes on how to sort of, you know, take these characters and make them feel like, you know, they're somewhere in between the real world and not.
And also, the way you've been fleshing out Bucky's story, it almost makes me wish that the new film would almost take a tact of, really, Bucky's story in terms of living up to the mantle of Captain America. And obviously the way you've been doing it in your book, but to really, you know, almost make it like, hey, that was a wonderful idea back in the 40s. How do we, you know, how does a new person try to honor that, you know, that reputation and make it work in the modern world is an interesting movie in and of itself.
Yeah, that's true. Well, they've done that a couple times in the book, but I think having it be Bucky, you know, is so much more poignant. And, you know, another, you know, thing where it's like, you know, I don't know if I've ever tread any completely new ground in Captain America. Like, my whole run is basically like, I really liked those three Stranko issues. Let's pretend he never left. And, you know, and then, you know, well, I remember that What If what Roy Thomas did, where Captain America didn't retire and, you know, or didn't get blown up, and then Bucky became Cap and Cap joined S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, it's like all this stuff that, you know. It's,
oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not, like, purposefully doing that, but it's like when Bucky became Cap, I was like talking to Brevoort, and he's like, yeah, it's just like that old Roy Thomas What If, and I was like, I think that was actually written by Don Glut.
Yep, that's exactly
that was Roy's story.
Well, and then Roy had that great story and you incorporated it into continuity.
No, it was always incorporated into continuity.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
That was considered the only issue of What If that actually is telling you a story that really did happen.
With
that is just basically, it's like the final issue of the Invaders.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that story is considered to be the incontinuity. This is how, you know, this is what happened after Captain America and Bucky blew up. You know, how, because that happened before the war was over.
Right.
You know, so they were telling the, and I love in Marvel's actual continuity that the fucking Human Torch lit Hitler on fire. Like, that's how the war ended in Marvel. Marvel did it before Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, absolutely, exactly. And that just does it. It makes Jim Hammond a stronger character. I liked, and you mentioned the Young Allies 70th anniversary one-shot. I loved the All-Winners one-shot, and I'm blanking on who wrote it right now. I don't have it in front of me. But
I can't remember who wrote that one either.
But, all right, and forgive us because we're giving it up to you without revealing your name because, again, we saw Jeff Mace, the Patriot, how he is dealing with, you know, having to assume the mantle and knowing that he isn't up to the role. And great character moments between him, Namor, Miss USA, or Miss America, everybody.
Yeah, they're fun, you know. I love that era. I mean, I'm so... You know, I kind of wish that the Marvels project was an ongoing book where we could just sort of go all the way to the mid-50s.
But, sure.
You know, obviously that would take us like 75 issues or something at the pace we're going. But I'm hoping that, you know, if this one does well enough after the first, you know, the first run, because we end the Marvels project, you know, with the formation of the Invaders after Pearl Harbor. And,
okay.
And, you know, so I'm hoping that if it's popular enough, we'll get to do a sequel that takes place, you know, during the war and, you know, and maybe another one that takes place in the early 50s or something. And, you know, just to sort of take some time with these characters and you know, they're just, it's so much fun. And it's so much fun to see Steve draw that stuff.
Sure.
He's so meticulously researching. I mean, wait till you see issue 3. There's a scene when Namor first comes to New York that he arrives at Coney Island. And it's just like, oh, man, like, it looks exactly like Coney Island at night in, like, 1940. It's just like all the rides are exactly right, and the people in their clothes and everything. It's just like, oh, man.
That was, you know, it was that attention to detail that always made Roy Thomas and when Don Glut was, you know, and I know Don was in What If. Roy was obviously, The Invaders was Roy's book. But that's
what
made
it. Don Glut took over The Invaders at some point. I didn't like it as much after that.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
They lost Frank Robbins at that point, too.
Okay. Because
the Frank Robbins issues of Invaders are the great ones.
Oh, I completely agree. And it's so funny because I really went from, and I've had this conversation with a million artists and writers in terms of, I don't know, there was just something that made me want to read those Frank Robbins books, and it was so drastically different than the Marvel House style of the day, but you couldn't help but be compelled by
it. And when they put him on Captain America, it's like he didn't know what to do. Like apparently, the story I heard is that when he drew those Nova issues of Captain America,
mm-hmm.
he didn't know that Nova was Steve Rogers. And he thought Nova could fly. And that's why there's a lot of panels where he's, like, leaping around and looking all weird. Apparently, like, the production department had to redraw a bunch of stuff so that because he just had Nova, like, flying. So there's a lot of odd pages in there. But, yeah, on the Invader stuff, give Frank Robbins World War II. And he's like, yeah, you know, it's like he's a guy who grew up, you know, drawing, like, Milton Caniff. So.
Absolutely. And Johnny Hazard, his own comic
exactly.
strip is such a beautiful strip.
Yeah, he's amazing. I mean, it's sad to think that the Invaders stuff is actually sort of the low point of his career as far as, you know, his abilities go, and it's still so, especially once, you know, they got Vince Coletta off of it and gave him Frank Springer inking him, then it really looked like his stuff, and, you know, it's still so much fun to read that stuff.
No, another unsung guy who not only drew a lot of great stories in the 60s and 70s, but wrote a lot of cool Batman stories and war stories.
Stuff, yeah.
You bet. Absolutely,
he might have written the first really modern Batman story, the one where, like, Dick goes away to college and Batman and Bruce moves into the penthouse in Gotham City.
Yep.
I think Frank Robbins actually wrote that.
I believe you are correct, sir. Very cool. Now, because I remember early on in the Cap run, you had that great interlude where you had the Invaders, you know, attacking Germans and stuff, and it was such a great scene. Michael Arcart and I remember talking to you and going, "Oh, we need more Invaders," and it just seemed like there might have been some sort of resistance from editorial standpoint to do any old stories. I mean, obviously this is the 70th anniversary, but has there been a change of heart as far as?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I know it's hard to get people to care as much about World War II
okay.
in this day and age, even though, you know, you say that and Call of Duty makes, you know, more money than God.
There you go.
But, you know, that's also, it's mostly because people can go online and shoot each other in the face. Hey, Brian and Matt. I don't know. I mean, I was definitely... You know, people loved that stuff in Cap. I think it's one of those things. I mean, we have so many flashbacks to that stuff in Cap. But I think, you know, I partially I think it was because I was so busy at the time that if I wanted to do like an Invaders miniseries or something, I probably could have gotten it off the ground, but I had so much stuff to do. And then,
sure.
you know, they not long after that started talking to Alex Ross, who, you know, really loves the Invaders, obviously. And so they were working out that deal to get Alex to come, you know, back and work for Marvel and, you know, do that stuff. So, you know, and Alex and I apparently grew up reading all the exact same comics, so we both feel incredibly possessive about all the same characters.
Is there a meeting, though? I mean, because I, and I bought that today as well as my last issue of
Incognito. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet, as well as Incognito.
How cool is that?
But very cool. Really, and that's scary. And that's exciting, and not knowing where his story
the
is going.
The art on that is really good, too. I really like that artist. I've never heard of him before.
I agree, and
one of the better artists that they've ever had on a Dynamite project, I know.
No, I definitely agree, and I thought it is, here it is, let's see. Birkencotter?
Never heard of him.
Never heard of him either, but it's very good, let's see. Patrick Birken, yeah, Patrick Birkencarter. Way to go, Patrick.
Yeah, probably, you know, working under Alex Ross's watchful eyes probably brings out the best in you.
Well, the I you know, obviously with Bucky being back, I can't help but be excited that Toro is now back too.
Yeah, it's I'm gonna, you know, I gotta talk to Alex more about that stuff once I get, you know, beyond my wall of Reborn and everything that's coming after that to see, you know, about how to fit this all together. But yeah, I know, it's like the Invaders are all back.
Which is great. I honestly, again, I love, I'm glad that Marvel is embracing their golden age again, beyond the 12, and I'm glad that Marvel's project is up and humming, and these one-shots have been great, and yeah, the Torch is a wonderful addition to that as well.
Yeah, well, he's such a cool character, too, and that's, I mean, one of the things that's been the most fun in the Marvel's project is getting to play with, you know, his early days where, you know, I mean, there was a lot of comics published starring him back then, but, you know, in our modern times, we haven't gone back and really touched on his story or that's the most exciting thing about the whole Marvel's project to me is being able to, you know, A, it was such an honor to be offered to write the origin of Marvel, you know, and really, like, this is the modern, you know, in continuity version of, you know, this is how it all happened. This is in continuity. This is canon. This isn't, you know, just some, you know, some story that, you know, we're saying this is how it happened, but we're going to change it like next week. Like, you know, they always do with Superman. Well, that seemed really mean and I didn't mean it to be, but yeah, it's just, you know, like to be offered to do that, you know, when I was a little kid being given, you know, the Stan Lee book, Origins of Marvel Comics, I never imagined that, you know, at some point in my life I would be given the opportunity to actually tell the origin of Marvel in one story. So I was like, oh, this is really daunting. But to get to go back and take all those early characters and really sort of flesh out their story and tell their stories in the way that comics have evolved, you know, I think our storytelling has really changed in the last, you know, 25, 30 years.
I agree.
The way we tell comic stories is completely different than it was back then. And, you know, so to be able to sort of take those characters and try to find what's cool about them and what works about them and you know, find the ones that actually make sense in, you know, in the Marvel world, and, you know, weave like this big epic story about their beginning it's a really fun challenge. And it's also like you stumble across a couple characters who maybe only appeared once or twice where you're like, why did they not continue this guy? You know, fuck it, I'm gonna bring him back, you know. So it's like there's some really interesting stuff that you can you know, come across. And I had no idea the Thin Man, who obviously, you know, was brought back, you know, by Roy Thomas.
Yes.
The Thin Man only appeared one time. And, like, he is accused of being a ripoff of Plastic Man, but he actually came out about a year before Plastic Man. And he could have been one of the coolest Marvel characters, actually. He was a really neat character. And, you know, but he just appeared one time. And then Roy Thomas remembered it, because Roy Thomas has every comic apparently ever. And, you know, so it was like, wow, if not for one guy, Roy Thomas, remembering this obscure, you know, Marvel character who appeared one time in, you know, in one comic that wasn't even named after him. So it's really amazing. But yeah, I mean, they had four characters appearing in every comic at least back then.
Right.
So like going through those, and you know, thank God for Jess Nevins, like, who's been, you know, helping me with the research on all this stuff, because I got him to put together a chronological list of every Marvel character published from the beginning up until just after Pearl Harbor, and like what, you know, who they were, what they did, like, you know, what they were, you know, what issue they were published in, when they first appeared, did they ever meet any of these other characters, like, and you know, you can go through the list and immediately it's like, okay, well, this guy's a Flash Gordon knockoff, we're not going to use him.
Sure.
You know, like, a lot of them aren't characters that make any sense being in our story, but you know, a lot of them are characters who you get to have a little Easter egg, you know, appearance of, like Monaco the Great. You know, I get to have him, like, you know, doing magic in Times Square, and you know, and you know, one of the characters I'm using is the Ferret. He's literally a private eye who operates out of Greenwich Village, who has a pet ferret that sits on his shoulder all the time, and otherwise he's basically just like the Shadow. but he's a private eye, but he dresses kind of like the Shadow. But he's got a ferret.
That's cool. Well, and
yeah,
there's
lots of weird little obscure Marvel characters who appear, you know, three or four times at most.
Okay. Well, then, because really, so much of my knowledge of the Timely characters came from those Roy Thomas Invader books, or the Liberty Legion that came out between the Invaders and the Marvel 2-in-1 with the Thing. That kind of reintroduced some of those characters. Are they, you know, we'll be seeing a lot of those heroes as well. You mentioned the Thin Man. I'm thinking of like Red Raven, Blue Diamond, some, you know.
Not any, only the ones that appeared, you know, in my timeline, basically.
Okay.
And as many of those as I can fit in will at least have little nodding appearances here and there.
Sure.
You know, like a newspaper article or somebody, you know, mentioning, oh, you hear so-and-so's operating out of Boston, or, you know, stuff like that. But you know, the cast keeps getting bigger every issue, so
cool.
it's a bit daunting. I mean, I'm in issue 4 is really the first time we see Steve Rogers. So, I mean, we've saw him in issue 1 briefly, but
right.
He doesn't actually come into the story until issue 4, and he's a main character, and, you know, it's an 8-issue series. So it really, you know, it's a story that it's really a sweeping, you know, epic in a huge way. And, you know, some of the main characters in it are, you know, Nazi spies who are over here trying to steal American secrets, and, you know, and some of them succeed, you know.
Cool.
So it's a really, you know, it's been probably the most fun I've had at Marvel, I gotta say. Like, at first I was like, oh man, the origin of Marvel, and then I was like, what a cool fucking gig.
Yeah.
You know, like, I get to reimagine how all this began, and you know, to take the books that were actually published back then, the modern retcons where we reimagined a lot of these characters, the bits and pieces of actual history that fit within that world, you know, and to then, you know, take stuff like, you know, well, in the origin of the 50s Captain America from, you know, the Steve Englehart issue,
mm-hmm.
it says that there was a Nazi spy who stole part of the super soldier serum and snuck it back to Germany. It's like, and, you know, so it's like, okay, well, that guy's got to be in this book. You know? So it's like, just figuring out stuff like that is like, it's been a lot of fun to find all those little bits and pieces and then figure out, okay, well, what are the threads that connect all these strands, and then that's how you build your story. And it's a really fun way to take a story. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that is almost never discussed, you know, now is that, you know, when the Human Torch first started out, one of the first things he did was became a cop. And so, you know, I'm using that in the story actually as a way for him to figure out, because he went from being like, you know, this thing
Android.
Everyone was afraid of to this hero. And it's like, well, he's trying to figure out how to be human and if he's human, and, you know, and then he's trying to figure out how to be a hero. So it's like it makes perfect sense for him to actually, you know, be a cop. So it's really fun. It's like I was doing an interview with someone yesterday, and they were asking me if there's an art to the retcon. And I was like, the art is to try to make it not feel like a retcon, you know, to make the reader not feel like ripped off while they're reading it, you know. And it's like the only retcon we've done so far in the Marvels project is, you know, well, obviously we did the thing with the Two-Gun Kid, but that's not really a retcon because, you know, maybe when he's 90 years old, he will be sent back in time. But, you know, with the thing with Namor, like the first time Namor encounters surface people, actually, is, you know, when it's Nazis who are dredging for, you know, Atlanteans. And, you know, I just, that to me was the kind of retcon that you have to do to make your story make sense, because it's like you take the actual history of the time where, you know, the Germans were doing some really horrific shit and actually, you know, experimenting on people. And, you know, one of the experiments that I mentioned in the first issue, and the scientist is actually like a German scientist who was doing that actual experiment that's mentioned. And, you know, but Prince Namor, if you go back to the early Submariner issues, like, he's kind of a bad guy.
Sure.
Like, he's definitely an anti-hero at best. He's, you know, I mean, he's like a terrorist in a way. And in our story, that's kind of, you know, at least for a while, that's kind of his modus operandi. He's like, he hates surface people, and he's going after them. And he doesn't distinguish between, you know, if you live on the surface, you're one of them. You
right.
Know? And it's, he's, you know, he doesn't have a map. You know? So I was like, well, there should be, you know, a better reason other than that my mom always warned me about you surface people, you know.
Absolutely.
And I just thought, okay, I'm doing this giant espionage story. I need to, you know, connect all these strands. And that was when that appeared to me. I was like, oh, what an amazing scene that, you know, there's Nazis, there's, you know, German ships, like, blowing up depth charges above Atlantis. And, you know, and you know, Atlanteans are rising to the surface and being dredged up. Like, what a horrifying thing to have, you know, be the first moment that Namor encounters people.
I wondered if this possibly explained the evolution of U-Man. Was it U-Man, the an Invaders character that seemed to be kind of an Atlantean sort of...
Well, that's not in this, but yeah, that definitely, you know... That definitely could be part of it, you know.
Because, sure.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, that was what I was thinking. It's like, well, a lot of it is just, you know, you know. I mean, a lot of writing stories is just asking yourself questions of like, well, how did this happen, or how did that happen, or, you know. And I was thinking, like, okay, Dr. Erskine is like this super Nazi genius who, you know, was creating the super soldier serum for the Germans, and then he, you know, somehow ended up working for the Americans. It's like, well, when did he escape? And, you know, what's the deal with that? And I was like, well, that's a story. And then I was thinking, well, like, why? And, you know, and then you're sitting there and you're imagining this thing with Submariner. You're like, oh, well, what if he's in this lab where he's having to fucking dissect these people to try to figure out why they are how they are and, you know, how they can take advantage of that? And it's like, you know, imagine the horrifying things that, you know, I mean, real scientists who defected from the Nazis.
Absolutely.
You know, like, so, but, you know, it's that's the one really cool thing, I think, about the way that, or one of the really cool things about the fact that the Marvel Universe kind of, you know, we always say it's your universe, but it is kind of, you know, it's like Marvel exists in our world. Like when, you know, when the whoever's president in the real world is president in the Marvel world, too. It's like, it's really bizarre. It's like, it's just like, you know, one dimension away from,
sure.
From, you know, I mean, obviously it's complete fiction, but, you know, but we acknowledge World War II happened, you know, all the things that are actually happening in the world, you know, have happened in the Marvel world. So I think that's really cool to be able to, you know, blend that fact and fiction history, you know, to take FDR and his actual secret intelligence group and make them, you know, part of the invention of the Human Torch and Captain America and, you know, because, you know, these were all real people really doing real espionage. So it's like, well, if we're doing a World War II story, they've got to be in it.
Certainly. And it's fun to see pre-World War II or pre-Howler Nick Fury operating as well. And it's interesting that a much younger and much less seasoned Nick Fury.
Yeah, exactly. Well, wait till next issue. He's great. Yeah, and that's all stuff, you know, a lot of that is stuff just either taking his actual backstory and, you know, just tweaking it a little bit, or, you know, I mean, the thing with him and Red is kind of a nod to, you know, an old story about the first time that they met Sawyer and got sent behind enemy lines, and, you know, that's it. I'm sort of taking that story and kind of tweaking it a little bit to make it fit this more, because, you know, it makes more sense that they would be sent back to, you know, to get the one guy who we never actually saw how he escaped from Germany. It's like, why has that story never been told?
Interesting. And I love the Angel, Thomas Holloway. And, you know, I kind of checked out, I think, when he became the Scourge. So, but yeah, you know, it's interesting because you almost see the seeds of the Scourge being planted here as well as the seeds for the Angel.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that Scourge thing with him. Like, didn't they say it was his twin brother? And like, well, I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of doing what Matt and I did with Iron Fist and just ignoring the cauliflower people.
Okay.
You know? It's a complicated enough story to tell without him also having a twin brother. And it's like, well, in the original origin of the Angel, you know, I'm using his pulp origin even, where he was, like, raised by the crazy dad in the, you know, who was the prison warden who raises his kid in a fucking prison wing.
Yeah.
You know, like, and forces him to read everything. And, like, I like that crazy pulp fiction version of his origin. So that's the one I decided to use.
Okay.
That makes him a much more interesting character if he's, you know, if he's this sort of Doc Savage, weird, you know, kind of guy.
Well, and again, influenced by, like you said, Matt Hawk, the Two-Gun Kid, and, you know, and I like that kind of the way time folds on itself, and that, you know, Matt was inspired by the heroes he saw in the future, and is, you know, in the best way that he can, conveying those images to Tom Holloway.
Yeah, I really liked that. A lot of people didn't seem to get that. I saw people commenting, like, why did they draw all the characters wrong? And it's like, he's imagining them from Matt Hawk's descriptions.
Right.
You know, like, I thought it was great. The Hulk has a mustache.
Yes. Everyone had a mustache. It was great.
Yeah.
No, it was very cool. And, you know,
everybody had mustaches back in 1938. Mustaches and hats.
Well, and again,
someone should have been wearing a fedora. It would have been funny if Reed Richards was wearing a fedora. I didn't think about that.
Well, and but also the Angel is one of those Golden Age characters that actually did have a pretty healthy publishing run. Am I correct?
Yeah, he was really popular in the day. He was in Marvel Comics number one, along with Submariner and the Human Torch, and you know he was on the cover, I think, of either issue 2 or issue 3. He was a really popular Marvel character. So it was, you know, just for some reason he never, you know, maybe because, you know, they had a guy named the Angel in the X-Men, you know,
they weren't bringing
back a lot of, you know, when they started the Marvel era, they really, other than Captain America, they didn't bring back a lot of the original characters. You know, I mean, there was a Human Torch in the Fantastic Four, but other than that, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, they didn't do what DC did by just, you know, taking all their old popular characters and doing new versions of them. They really, I mean, I don't think they realized they had any popular characters back then because, you know, other than Cap and Namor and the Human Torch, you know, they probably didn't. And I don't know, I think they continued publishing those characters to the point where they didn't sell anymore. And then in the 50s, they tried to bring Cap back, and it was pretty much a flop, I think. And
yeah,
they went
actually
back to doing the weird shit, and so yeah, the John Romita, you know,
exactly
run in the 50s that you know is now known as the 50s Cap stuff. But I think that was actually kind of a bomb. So when Stan and Jack and those guys were starting, you know, what became Marvel Comics, I don't think they even considered, you know, bringing back the old characters because I don't think they thought anybody would give a damn. You know, so that's why it's only, you know, in recent years or, you know, Roy Thomas did it here and there, but, you know, it was never as big a thing as, you know, DC is like the legacy characters and Marvel is like, you know, doing its own, you know, doing a different thing with that. And I think it's kind of cool that Marvel is now becoming, you know, like touching back on its history a bit more and doing more legacy kind of stuff. Like it's interesting how the companies become more like each other sometimes.
Sure, and I think it makes sense again because it's Marvel's 70th anniversary to kind of, you know, go into these areas. But also you've got a lot of these just one dimensional images of these Golden Age characters that are essentially a blank slate and can be any type of hero you want them to be because the stories were so, you know, crudely written for its time to 10-year-olds in the 1940s.
Yeah.
You know, I always say that about, I'm glad that DC is kind of exploring Freddie Freeman because I'm like, wow, there's like one Golden Age character that really hasn't been given a chance to be his own character until now.
He had a crutch and he said, He said Captain Marvel, and that's it.
Pretty much. You know, and, well, luckily...
And that's why you liked him. He looked cool, and he had a crutch.
You know, he had Mac Rayboy and drawing.
Oh, yeah. The Mac Rayboy stuff is amazing.
Yeah. So, but yeah, the same can be said for all these Marvel characters as well, that now is their chance. I remember when Brian, in his run on Daredevil, had a quick scene with the Angel, with the guy before the Kingpin, Bolt. And I was like, oh, cool, there's the Angel. And then, of course, he gets the shit kicked out of him. And I'm like, oh, that was too bad.
Was it the Angel, actually?
I'm pretty sure the Angel.
I thought it was Manhunter.
Oh, I thought it was the Angel.
I can't remember who it was now. Let me look. I've got it right here.
Good, because
that's in volume 4 or 5. I think it's volume 5.
I forget the name of the arc. I'd know it better from the name of the arc.
Oh, yeah, it's got the old car on the front. Yeah, I think he was supposed to be the Destroyer because he had those weird striped pants.
Oh, I kind of thought he was the Angel, because I guess I seem to remember wings being on his
Yeah, I remember that, too.
And the cape. And
here it is. It's the issue that's got all the weird art in it.
Yeah, which was great. It had the
it's in black and white. He's got striped pants.
Oh, maybe it's not the Angel, then.
Yeah, I don't know who he is.
Well, anyway.
I'll email you later and tell you. You bums got this shine coming, but good. The Defender.
It is the Defender.
That's
okay.
They call me the Defender. Yeah, he's like I love that. They just blow him away. But yeah, it's. I mean, yeah, exactly. Some of those characters are really just, you know, literally. I mean, come on, the Ferret. Like I appeared like 3 times. One of my favorite characters so far in the Marvels project is a guy who appeared literally 1 time, and his story is so weird, like, that clearly, like, the writer wanted it to be World War II, and the artist thought it was World War I, and so there's elements of both World War I and World War II in it, and I'm like, oh my god, I gotta use this somehow. Like, so I figured out a way to actually use this character, because I realized, like, researching him, that he had, like, at least a few obvious sort of threads or links to a modern Marvel character where I'm like, oh, shit, that can be, you know, this. And it's like, that's been a lot of fun, like, finding little things like that.
Very cool. Excellent. Well, I know we got 7 more issues to go, so I enjoyed the first issue. And
wait till you see issue 2. It kicks issue 1's ass.
Very cool.
I really, Steve and Dave Stewart, like, I loved what they, you know, what Stewart did on top of Epting in the first issue, but I feel like with issue 2, like, they really got a feel for working with each other more, I think, and you really, maybe it's just me not used to seeing Steve colored by anybody but Frank, but, and, you know, I love Frank's colors on Steve, but seeing Dave brought this other kind of palette to it, like it's a little bit more bright and a little, you know, different. Every colorist has like a palette that they use. Seems like, and you know, so to see, it's just, I don't know. It looks almost like painting, you know, on top of Steve. Like some of the stuff, especially the Human Torch stuff, looks like a painting, and it's really, it's just, I've really been blown away by seeing, you know, what Dave does on top of Steve's stuff, and. I just, you know, the Human Torch stuff in the next issue is so amazing looking that I can't believe it. So
very cool.
I just, you know, I can't wait to see how he colors the third issue, which I guess he's about to start coloring. So yeah, it's really it's a lot of fun. And I've the weirdest thing was I heard from a couple retailers that people thought it was a crossover, and like they were like, yeah, I was having trouble selling it to people because they thought it was a crossover, and I'm like, the Marvels project. Like, I was like, it's the origin of Marvel. Just tell them that. And they were like, yeah, I guess like a couple of them were like, I don't want to buy another crossover. And I was like, I guess now we've trained people that if anything's 8 issues long, it's a crossover.
Interesting.
So I was like, well, tell them it's not. But, yeah, I hope it's, you know, the hope is that we'll be creating something that will stand, you know, the test of time and that, you know, For 20 years from now, if someone's like, well, how did Marvel start? You know, they'll be at a Disneyland somewhere, you know, on Mars, and someone will go, oh, well, you buy this book. Here, it's a chip. You insert it into your brain.
Well and I, you know, the one complaint I heard, and I was ready to smack somebody, was they're like, well, this is just Marvel's readdress. I'm like, no, I think it's more fleshed out. And if anything, both books complement each other.
Yeah, I mean, I tried really hard. You know, I was a big fan of Marvel's, especially that first issue.
Sure.
But, you know, that's 20-something pages to cover the entire 1940s.
Exactly.
You know, and it's like, so I've tried really hard, you know, to not tread on its feet and make sure that I'm not over-covering the same ground, you know, and making sure that it's like, I mean, A, Marvel's isn't, you know, considered in continuity. It's like an out-of-continuity thing.
I didn't realize that.
Well, it goes from, you know, I mean, the stuff that happens in Marvel's happens when Marvel comics were being published. You
right.
Know, it's like the 40s,
oh, that's
60s,
a good point.
The 70s.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's like,
so Gwen's
yeah,
in
mean,
the 60s and everything.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, the second issue is about the 60s and stuff. And it's like, it actually deals with the time periods as the books were published. So,
true.
You know, in this way, it's a standalone project. And, you know, it is very much, you know, a thing that, you know, people who love it consider it in continuity. But, you know, with the sliding Marvel timeline,
I understand.
You know, you can't, you know, but everyone will accept that the first issue is at least in continuity. And, you know, so I tried really hard to make sure that I didn't violate any of that stuff as a fan of the material and, you know, because it's cool stuff. And, you know,
bet.
And why tread over the same ground that has already been walked on before? You know, it's like, that's why in our scene where the Human Torch is underground, we've got, you know, the Alex Ross thing with the headphones and, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, I tried really hard. That's why I didn't spend as much time in the first issue with the Torch, actually, with the, you know, the Torch's origin and stuff like that, and tried to show scenes that they didn't show in there.
Sure.
But it was that's definitely, you know, I mean, and ours is, it's from an insider's point of view, and it's a different story. I mean, ours is an espionage story at heart. So it's a variety of things. It's a mystery. It's an espionage. It's, you know, it's a superhero epic. So it's a lot of things all in one.
Now they're all my favorite subjects, and I look forward to peeling the onion further and finding exactly where we go.
That'll do it for part one of the Brubaker testimony. Don't worry, we have more to say. I know we haven't covered Daredevil yet. That's coming up in part two, along with more talk about Captain America Reborn and our usual pop culture mix of great TV, film, and books that Ed has been reading and watching, and he passes it along. We also discuss Angel of Death and how the DVD was received by the public. So all that coming up in the Brubaker testimony part two. Thanks a lot for listening. This episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. You'll find a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, anything. If it's in trades, you're likely to find it at InStockTrades.com with retail prices slashed down to up to 40% off for major publishers. For example, the various arcs of Criminal that have been collected so far at InStockTrades.com, the standard retail price usually is $14.99. At InStockTrades, just $7.94. There's one particular Criminal arc that's called The Dead and the Dying. That standard retail price was $11.99. At InStockTrades.com, $7.55. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, for all your monthly pre-order needs. You should check them out. Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Thanks for listening. John Suntress reminding you, come to our home site, wordballoon.com. You'll not only find audio there, but video as well, interviews with your favorite comic book creators, and also check out our iTunes page and leave us a review. We'd appreciate it. Questions or comments about the show, there's the Word Balloon message board at wordballoon.com, or you can email me, john at wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.